This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Lawrence Grossberg has spent more than two decades documenting the rise of the political right. In his latest book, he locates Donald Trump's presidency within this bigger historical picture. Under the cover of chaos, Trump and the battle for the American right digs into the turmoil of the Trump administration. In it, he argues conservatives are winning the American culture war through long-term planning and real political debates. Lawrence Grossberg is a professor of communications and cultural studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he joins us now. Larry, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You talked about this. You've been tracking this for a while now, and you talk about the infrastructure, the kind of right-wing infrastructure that's been building in for several decades. Give us a picture of that.
Well, I think, there's a long history of conservatism, but in the 1950s and 60s, partly in response to the New Deal and to the events of the 50s and 60s, a group of conservatives began to rethink American conservatism and rethink how to strategize what one might characterize as a political and cultural revolution in this country. And part of that involved a long-term project. They understood that it would take them decades. And part of it involved a recognition that they needed to build a whole set of interlocking institutions that were able to mobilize resources, speak to different populations, bring them together. So you got a series of think tanks like the Heritage and the Cato. You got organizations like the Federalist Society, which was attempting to intervene into the legal apparatus of the United States. You got organizations like ALEC, which basically writes legislation before the fact, so that when the stage is set for that, you got obviously anti-feminist organizations. I mean, there was a very strategic, and I don't mean to suggest one conspiracy. And the nice thing about conspiracies is there are always multiple conspiracies and multiple versions of this revolution, but they nevertheless understood that they were moving together, trying to move the country in the same direction.
But this is a response, as you say, an anti-feminist movement, to name one. And you talk about the, sort of right-wing or right-leaning think tanks. They're in a response to an infrastructure that is already there for liberals. These think tanks are already there on the left.
Well, though, I mean, there were and still continue to be what I guess we would call liberal centrist think tanks. It's not the case that following the 60s, the emergent left, let's call it, which was not affiliated directly with the Democratic Party, nor with particular academic positions, that left did not do the kind of infrastructural work of creating their own think tanks. There's, for example, in my research, I came across an interview with one of the directors of the Heritage Foundation, who made the statement that their biggest worry was that the left would realize they had the biggest think tank possible. Mm-hmm. It was called the universities. And if they would just start talking to each other, instead of attacking each other, Then actually the Heritage Foundation would have a problem.
You also make the point that the left tends to pick on issues. And so while there may be universities that might have research that promote certain or support issues, that the right was really about an ideology. It was about an anti-government ideology that really wanted to strip regulation, all of these sort of things, that was probably more coherent than what you might see on the left.
Well, the conservatives, again, after the 50s and 60s, brought together, I think, a number of political, ideological notions. What was a real revolution in conservatism for conservatives to become pro-capitalist? Traditionally, conservatives thought capitalism destroyed values.
Talk more about that, because we now think that they are in lockstep with each other, right? That This is what a conservative is, a supporter of capitalism.
And certainly people like Russell Kirk and William Buckley in the 60s forged that alliance. I mean, Barry Goldwater was fairly strongly against corporate capital, supported small business capitalism. That had to be moved and redefined. And over the years, you know, part of my analysis suggests that over the 50 or 60 years, the right has been a shifting series of coalitions, and different fractions of capitalism enter into the conversation with Christians, with a religious conservatism, with various kinds of secular conservatism, anti-big government, which, you know, connects to certain capitalist desires to cut back on regulation. Right. So you have a series of shifting alliances amongst different versions of conservatism and different versions of capitalism and different versions of religion and moralism that come together at different points with a kind of common direction.
The common direction may be seen in the kind of cultural values, or at least the cultural work that's done on the right to cultivate ideology through culture rather than kind of rational debate.
Well, I think that the conservatives, the right, let's call them, because we now have to deal with a reactionary right, which traditionally the post-World War II conservatives renounced. So, you know, Reagan, Buckley, and those people, they refused to allow the reactionary right,
Ku Klux
the
Klan,
white supremacist right.
The
Confederacy, pro-Confederate. Right. They refused to allow them into the conservative alliance. You know, we've now seen them.
But forgive me for interrupting you, but they were happy to use them as followers to promote the kind of white supremacist divisions that would support
they were happy to use them to maintain their ties to forms of right-wing politics and thought that they were not willing to take in public.
Right.
Now, you know, or they did it indirectly, or they did it in contradictory ways. Now we've seen these groups, these neo-fascists, white supremacists, come into the alliance of the right in ways that are quite new. It seems to me one of the things I find is that beyond certain very broad ideological principles like anti-government, anti-state, but, you know, again, that varies from one moment to another of what they mean by anti-state, Trump being an expression of one of the most radical positions. But there were people under the second George Bush administration who also talked about basically deconstructing the state.
Government is the problem, right?
Yes.
And this is after a long period when working class people understood the government was their friend, that their right to protect themselves in the workplace came because the government passed legislation defending their rights. That is stripped away by the Republicans. They lose their rights. And then when they look around and see what happened, there's Ronald Reagan to talk about welfare queens, dog whistle politics.
I mean, it's partly, you know, a strategy. On the right, austerity politics is a brilliant strategy whereby you cut the ability of the state to actually provide the services people need. And then, of course, people get angry because the state is failing them and they don't want to pay more taxes, so you can further cut the state. So it is a brilliant anti-government strategy.
Talk about how easy it is and how well it works then to blame the other. And this is where white supremacy works so well. And the idea that it's somehow the other among us. This is a cultural and a highly irrational, fearful notion that supports right-wing conservative ideology today.
Let me just, you know, about the last issue about the state, say it's also the case that the state has failed. Now, it's partly that the left has failed to educate people that the state did work, that, you know, it's support of labor unions, it's the creation of the New Deal programs. These were important systems that did work. And we didn't kind of remind people why workers were willing to die for unions. But it's also the case that the state over the past 30 years, let's say, has failed to deliver on what people took to be the promises. The Republicans have just been very good at mobilizing that failure.
How would that look? How if the left were to take a cue from what you're saying, because I'll talk now about your solutions and what the left should do. What would that look like? How, because there were people who were making the case that you got here because of, you know, and there were Kennedys, and there were people who were absolutely making the case, even a Ted Kennedy later in the 80s, making the case that this is how you got here. And it didn't work. So what was successful in the rhetoric of the right, and how could the left actually take that back?
Because I think, and this will come back to the question of the other, but I think the right understood that this was a culture war. The left has always assumed this is a political ideological war. The left understood that this was a culture war. You know, Breitbart has up on its website the statement that politics is downstream from culture, that you change the culture and then you change the politics, whereas the left has always thought you change the politics and the culture will follow somehow inevitably, and it doesn't work that way. And moreover, the right understood that a culture war in contemporary America wasn't about ideology and it wasn't about systems of belief, because most Americans still support a kind of social welfare liberalism. It's about how people feel. And it's about changing how people feel about things and then linking those feelings up to particular political kinds of behavior, which is what they, I think, do with the question of the other. So, you know, politics has, especially in the United States and Europe, has often demonized the other in a variety of ways, forms of racisms, forms of sexisms and patriarchy. But there's a particularly interesting complexity. And part of, you know, what I want to argue is people have to understand both the complexity and the historical specificity of what's going on. But in order to understand that, you have to understand the longer history of how we got here to understand what's unique. America has a long history of xenophobia, you know, the Italians, the Jews, the Poles, the Germans, they were all treated with disdain and hatred. So, but it isn't just saying, well, America is a xenophobic society. It's figuring out the ways in which xenophobia is being deployed in the service of a culture war. And I think it has to do precisely with the kinds of nationalism that the reactionary right is offering to us. And it's in particular a kind of nationalism that is simultaneously absolute. So if you are an American, your Americanness comes first. Nothing else can equal the fact that being American matters above all. But of course, then, they don't tell us what being American means.
But let me ask you again how this plays out, because look at this. There's two forms of nationalism, one that supports an ideology of freedom, equal rights, multiculturalism, and fairness to all, and including protection of minorities. That is an American principle.
Right.
It's embedded even as an afterthought in the American Constitution. So it's there. And then there's the America that is white and Protestant. And so now what do we do? The one that seems to win and is easiest to promote on the right is the white America. That's what nationalism is. When you make America great again, we're talking about protecting the privilege, the unearned privilege of white Americans. Why not, when you say we're going to take a knee and reflect on the protest we have as people of color with regard to the penal system in America, that's an Americanism. It's a form of nationalism, and it is mostly reviled. Why does one continually take precedence? It seems like there's a 60-40 split here, and one's always the winner. Well, is there a way to turn the equation?
Well, I mean, again, I think it's more complicated. I think the intellectual's job is to always start by saying it's more complicated, and let's look at the complications, because if we don't understand the complications, we're not going to win the battle. There are certainly elements within the Republican Party, significant elements, and certainly within the reactionary right, who are racist and believe in a white America. But there are lots of people who are supporting that who aren't racist or whose racism is not of the same kind as that of the white supremacist, who would not agree that what they want is a white nation and anyone of color or difference is to be excluded. I mean, as I said, I think this is not, see, we fight the ideological battle. Yeah, you know, this America is freedom, democracy, et cetera, and that's good and that's important. And we accuse the other side of negating our ideology because they're racist, sexist, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of, I think, looking at the way the appeal works. Now, there are certainly dog whistle elements in it.
How would you turn it? What way would it work to flip the equation?
Well,
what would be the language that you would use? Because it's always whether or not I believe this. If my candidate is going to support the erosion of environmental protection and I'm a corporation, I want to see that. That's helpful to me. I pay less. Right? That increases my margin. I like big margins. So maybe I'm a racist, maybe I'm not. But if I can get people to be afraid of others and they'll vote for my conservative candidate who also will erode environmental rights, who cares what I believe? I got what I wanted. The Koch brothers really don't like Donald Trump very much, and they got more from him than they got from Ronald Reagan.
And much of Trump's policy, much of Trump's actual policies, like the tax cut, et cetera, have been on the Republican agenda since the 1980s. He's giving what the new right wanted. But how to change the conversation or how to change the public discourse seems to me quite difficult. And again, it's long term. Right. And again, it is not. I think we have to engage with people who don't agree with us, whether they're in the left and they don't agree with, you know, the ways you act out your politics or, in that middle of the country, at least, which is at least ambivalent about where their politics is. We have to understand what people are feeling and how we can use those feelings to forge a different kind of politics.
Lawrence Grossberg, a professor of communications and cultural studies at UNC Chapel Hill. The book is called Under the Cover of Chaos, Trump and the Battle for the American Right. Larry, thank you so much.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.